Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking apart this week's question time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
Look behind you. They're not impressed, and neither's the country.
You stupid woman.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday, the 23rd of December. That can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, we've had drones over Gatwick Airport this week, disrupting flights. We've had the Conservative Party drones in Parliament, disrupting any form of meaningful debate. And of course, we've had the mainstream media drones in the Westminster bubble, doing the usual pile-on on Jeremy Corbyn. But don't you worry, there's no mindless robots to be seen on this week's episode. Only some very fabulous guests talking about the week's hottest news and bringing you some of the freshest music around. Hang on, what's that? Is that the Coca-Cola crony capitalist Santa coming down my chimney? I think he's going to empty his sack all over my front room floor. Let's find out what gifts he's got in store for me in this week's Topple Uncaged. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. Right, everyone, you know what this section is. Yes, it's Plucked News. Five news stories, 5 minutes. Can I get it done before Christmas Day and you need to put the turkey in the oven? Let's find out in 3, 2, 1. Let's go. First off, we're up to The Guardian, and they reported that Gatwick flight suspended after reports of drones over runway. This is a story, of course, of drones disrupting Gatwick Airport on Thursday, 20th of December. They caused absolute chaos, tens of thousands of people stranded, flights delayed, the airport completely closed for at least 24 hours. As this was a developing story, I don't have the latest updates, but by the looks of it, these were not two people just playing with their hobby drones. It looked like something more coordinated. Who are we going to blame? Probably the Russians. But, of course, there are wider implications for this story that no one else is picking up on. Edward Snowden famously said that the Investigatory Powers Act was the most intrusive and least accountable surveillance regime in the West. And I believe this drone incident will be used by the government to clamp down even more on the activities of activists, independent filmmakers and journalists. Not least because it will be used to bring in legislation to control the use of drones. Trust me, we will see independent filmmakers and journalists no longer able to record with drones wherever they want, and we'll see the clamping down of campaigners and activists using them for the monitoring of protests and the surveillance of sites. As is always the case with this government, whenever events happen, they will use them against us, specifically the left. So watch this space. Trust me, drones, it's not just going to be Tarquin flying his one over Dulwich Park, which is going to be an issue anymore. And for the second story, we're off to BBC News, and they said that Waste Plan floats bottle deposit scheme. This is talking about plans the government quietly sneaked out on Tuesday the 18th of December, specifically that we might have to pay a bit extra as a deposit on drinks containers, including coffee cups. We then get this deposit back when we recycled them. Apparently some environmental campaigning groups are cheering this move. Whoa! What? This is once again us, the citizen, being penalised for what huge corporations are doing. Why are we having to pay a bit extra when it's actually manufacturers producing these damn plastics which are filling up our oceans and destroying numerous species? But as always, of course, this is the way it goes. We can't possibly hit manufacturers' profits too much, therefore the original sin, that is, we are all responsible for the climate mess, gets passed on to every single one of us. Never mind the fact that in the past 30 years, 70% of greenhouse gas emissions have been caused by just 100 corporations. We need to wake up and realise that the climate catastrophe and ecological crisis we are facing is being unfairly put onto us when we can do very little about it. It's politicians and corporations that need to act now. And for the third story, we're across to Twitter and My Mates Well campaign. They tweeted, "Thank you Debbie Abrahams and Kate Green SU for taking this debate forward for us with Backbench Committee and to everyone who has supported the request for a cumulative impact assessment. Hashtag Well Debate." This is the story of the War on Welfare Well campaign and their quest to have a debate in Parliament about the impact of cuts and changes to welfare that the government has put in place since 2010. A cumulative impact assessment is where the government looks at the effects and consequences, both positive and negative, of actions or policies. Specifically, WOW are calling for this in respect to disabled people and the changes to welfare. Now, this debate has been absolute chaos. It was supposed to be scheduled originally for the 29th of October. It then got cancelled at that time due to Brexit. Then it was scheduled for Wednesday the 19th of December after PMQs. But due to Keir Starmer's debate on the no-deal Brexit, it got pushed back to 5 o'clock. Then we thought it was going to be cancelled. Then it got pushed back to 7 o'clock. Finally, the debate happened, but not after sick and disabled people were made to wait around in Parliament for hours and hours as an as. This is simply not good enough because, once again, it gives the impression that Parliament does not give a shit about sick and disabled people. But moreover, the result of the debate was Sarah Newton, Disability Minister, saying, well, we can't do that. We can't do a cumulative impact assessment because the figures are too complicated. Nonsense. One think tank has already done it and found that, on average, people would be £40 a week worse off by 2020. But as everything to do with welfare, sick and disabled people, the government are essentially lying and attempting to divert attention from their callous, cruel and nefarious policies by saying, we're trying our best. No, you are not. You are human rights abusers and everyone is beginning to see it. And for story number four, I'm off to Sky News, and they reported that homeless man who slept rough outside Parliament dies. This is the story of Gula Remes, a man who found himself homeless and ended up sleeping rough outside Parliament, who died on Tuesday the 18th of December. This is now the second person this year rough sleeping to die outside Parliament. And it is a damning indictment of our government. But also, I'm afraid, politicians more broadly. These politicians must see people rough sleeping outside Parliament, walk past them every day, probably turn their noses up and just carry on like nothing's happening. The government has pledged $100 million to eradicate rough sleeping and homelessness, but as groups like Streets Kitchen will tell you, this is simply not enough. Especially when you have benefit reforms like universal credit just exacerbating homelessness, rent arrears, and housing difficulties. Low estimates say there are 24,000 people going to be sleeping rough or in cars or in tents this Christmas. This is probably a gross underestimate, but we need to look at the root causes of this situation. It's not necessarily the Conservative government, although it has gone up staggeringly by 169% since they came in 2010, but homelessness and housing issues have always been a problem. Why do we have this? It's our capitalist hierarchical top-down society that we live in. And until we solve this, I'm afraid very little will probably change. Gula, rest in power. And finally, I'm back home to the Canary and my mate Freya Lockley, and she reported that UK is still one of the worst-ranked Western European countries for press freedom as journalists' deaths rise globally. This is the story of Reporters Without Borders saying that the UK has kept its status as one of the worst-ranked Western European countries in the World Press Freedom Index. We are 40th for the second year running. This is staggering! Given the constant narrative we hear about our free, brave British press, it's absolute bollocks. Of course, Reporters Without Borders says this is partly due to things like the Investigatory Powers Act clamping down on what journalists can and can't do, and the foray with The Guardian where the government went in and smashed their hard drives over the Edward Snowden revelations. However, we have a bigger problem with our establishment media in this country, and that is exactly it. It's the fact that it is in establishment media. Over 50% of journalists, which the industry regards as the UK's top 100, went to private school. You see week in, week out, BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Sky News journalists schmoozing with Conservative politicians. And then you have the likes of David Dimbleby, gone from Question Time but not forgotten, who went to Eton himself. The problem isn't so much that the government are clamping down in the press in this country, but it doesn't help. The issue is we are surrounded and immersed in the Westminster bubble groupthink, whereby these mindless drones, as I referred to them earlier, all say the same thing, think the same thing, and give us the same narrative, ultimately controlled by what the government wants us to hear. Our media is absolutely broken in the UK, therefore it is imperative that you continue to support sites like us at the Canary, others like Squawkbox and Evolve Politics, to really bring you the news that matters. And to hand in, we had time to talk about Taiwan's Yellow Vest Movement. Yes, 10,000 people marched on the presidential office on the 19th of December, calling for an end to illegal taxation and reform of tax laws. Now, what's so important about this story? I didn't even know Taiwan had a Yellow Vest movement, but apparently it's been going since 2016. So yes, if you thought France was first off the mark with it, you're sorely mistaken. It started in Taiwan. All solidarity to you over there, guys. Nor have I had time to talk about Trump pulling US troops out of Syria. I'm not sure what's going on here. I mean, the president in the run-up to the election in 2016 said he would withdraw all US troops from foreign wars in the Middle East. Then, this year, after the Duma nerve agent attack, lols, he went and bombed Syria. And now suddenly he's pulling all his troops out, much to the surprise not least of people within his own party. I personally think Trump is being torn between his own agenda and the pulling of the deep state. However, what we are seeing is the usual US modus operandi. That is, cause absolute carnage in a Middle Eastern country and then leave it to burn. And to hand in their time to mention a bunch of parasites feeding off their host this week, that is the royal family joining Queen Elizabeth for a Christmas festive lunch at Buckingham Palace. You make me sick. 120,000 children will be without a home this year, and food bank use is expected to skyrocket. Meanwhile, you lot go and fill your gluttonous, self-serving stomachs at the expense of the rest of us. Abolish the monarchy now. Oh my god, and I nearly forgot. I haven't had time to wish you all a very merry capitalism. Sorry. I mean, happy Christmas. Can I just say, do you not think it's time to stop celebrating Christmas, unless you're a Christian, of course, and if you believe that magic fairy tale, good for you. Christmas, a time of increased debt, increased loneliness that is stalking this country. The number of people taking their lives goes up. 120,000 children will be homeless. And yet, we still keep buying into this corporatist capitalist agenda, wasting thousands and thousands of pounds on something none of us actually believe in. Do you know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see the left as a whole next year make a concerted effort to ignore Christmas. We can send out anti-capitalist Christmas cards. Instead of cooking Christmas dinner, we can all go out and do good deeds in our communities. And we can certainly switch off our damn tellies with all the corporatist capitalist crap that's on them. So, Merry Bloody Christmas, not next year. Come on, guys, let's do it. Anti-capitalist Christmas. And on that note, I'm off to start mine. However, I'm not finished yet, because next up we have... dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, free-flying with... as if my year hadn't been bad enough, it's just gone a bit more crazy. To be honest, I started off the year being interviewed by this next gentleman, then I ended up somehow doing my own show alongside him, and suddenly the year's ending and he's doing my show being interviewed by me. Really, I have had the craziest year, and this just tops it all off. But it's only the legendary George Galloway, me old mucker, is joining me on Topple Uncaged. George, thank you so much for coming on.
No, it's a pleasure. I'm your biggest fan. I'm honored to be here.
Oh.
And a year's a long time in politics, as someone nearly said, and it's a long time in media too. You've achieved some things that I haven't achieved in the last year, like being on the BBC. It's been some years since I was on the BBC.
It was Question Time, wasn't it? You were last on, actually.
I think if it was Question Time, that's at least 2 years ago.
That is, yeah, I remember that.
And I was on Question Time for the first time in 1984, in the middle of the miners' strike.
Mm.
And I was on it regularly and relatively successfully in terms of audience share and so on. Every year, maybe once, twice, sometimes even more.
Mm.
But it's been some time since the... I darkened their door. Anyway, well, it's no loss what a friend gets. I hope you get plenty more opportunities.
Thank you, sir. You always... The listeners won't know this. George is such a lovely guy. He's the nicest person I have met. So it's always a pleasure. I look forward to my Tuesday filming with you, as you know, George. So
yes, and we're even going... we're going to tread the boards together, but more of that later.
This is more madness. But yes, we will talk about that in the new year. Right, yeah. Let's kick things off, George. So as always with this section on Topple Uncaged, Twitter decided one of the stories via a poll, and then the other two have been ones thrashed out by you and me. So we're going to start. We can't avoid it. It's been absolute bedlam at Gatwick Airport on Thursday with chaos with drones. The latest updates, we are recording late on a Thursday evening, are that apparently Ryanair, for starters, is the first air company to kick off advising passengers not to turn up at all on Friday at Gatwick Airport, and the authorities are saying that Gatwick will be closed to at least 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. They still haven't found the drone operators. I'm waiting for them to blame Putin. George, what's your take on this scenario?
You say you've been waiting for them to blame Putin, but it's already happened. And in the Twitter feed of Mrs. Alistair Campbell, no less, Fiona Miller, a couple of hours ago, seriously floated the possibility that Putin might have done it.
Oh,
I suppose we should be relieved, because I was kind of half fearing that Jeremy Corbyn might get the blame, you know, that a man on a bicycle was seen peddling away from the scene of the crime.
Manically eating marrow, yes.
Yes, exactly, with some vegetables in his pannier, his basket, in the front of the bicycle. But all joking apart, and there's much to joke about, but there wouldn't be if you were there at Gatwick with your family, going off for a Christmas, New Year holiday that you'd worked all year to pay for.
No, of course.
It is a state of absolute chaos, and it's taken 20 hours even to call the British Armed Forces in, when quite clearly this is an attack on the commercial and industrial integrity fabric of Great Britain PLC. I have no idea how much money has been lost, but it must run now into many millions of pounds. And as the security services and the armed forces are supposed to defend us from all such threats, it's extraordinary that, number one, the government went to ground. No government minister has come forth and explained or sought to reassure or in any way appeared in command of this situation. As I say, the army wasn't brought in for 20 hours. Now they're in. But it does make you wonder if the, and many admirals and generals feel the same, by the way, the lion's share of our defense budget, easily, some 60%, is going on the maintenance of nuclear weapons, which can't be used except in the scenario of the literal end of the world.
Yes.
And we're not able to defend our second biggest airport, London's number two airport. We're not able to defend it. We're not able to clear it of drones, which are commercially sold. I'm told you can buy them in Halfords.
Yes.
And we're not able to track down who's doing it.
It's a bizarre situation, really, that the government, as you say, is not prepared for this. But you highlight it quite nicely about Trident, because I remember back in around, I think it was 2010, the Royal United Services Institute did a report for the government about what the biggest threats would be this century, the 21st century, against our security as a state, as a country. Obviously, nuclear didn't come up at all. They talked about cyber terrorism. They talked about, obviously, Islamic extremism, and they talked about climate change. But nuclear did not come up. And it seems that both the government and also the security service and the armed forces have completely dropped the ball on the possibility of things being done by drone. You thought they'd be prepared for this.
Well, yes, especially as, you know, on Despicable Me, I don't know if reality has caught up with it yet, but in Despicable Me, drones are delivering things to people's doors.
Yes.
Practically delivering their milk. So these drones can get anywhere. And yet no one seems to have had a plan in place to stop them buzzing an airport and causing economic devastation. The truth is, as Roussi, like a stop clock right twice a day, identified, the major threats to us are asymmetrical. They are not a pitched battle with tanks somewhere on the plains of Central Europe. They are not against any adversary at whom we could fire a nuclear weapon without incinerating everybody. They are exactly this. Some guy sat in his underpants in an attic or upstairs in his mother's house coordinating this kind of thing. And it just makes us look so utterly amateur, quite apart from the economic and social public dislocation that it's caused.
No, absolutely.
It's extraordinary to me that you're not able to, you see, if you can't defend against these things, then they shouldn't be being sold.
No.
They shouldn't be on sale in Halfords for anyone to buy them. They shouldn't be able to be to come within miles of an airport. It's illegal to do so, it shouldn't technically be possible. If you can, your phone can be cut off in certain places by electronic jamming, why can't we electronically jam these drones so that they literally cannot fly anywhere near our airports? But there's been no Cobra meeting. you get a Cobra meeting if somebody's lacking in impartiality on an RT television program, but not if you brought a decent part of the traveling public to a grinding halt. And I suppose it sums up the place we are as a country. We spent, and I know we're going to talk about this later, but we spent the last days of a parliamentary session, which is now broken up for 17 days Christmas holiday, not discussing the state we're in, homeless people dying on the doorstep of Parliament, pensioners shivering in the bleak midwinter, our children, as we know from the United Nations report, some of them actually hungry, millions of them living in grinding poverty, a constitutional crisis, the likes of which we have possibly never seen in this country. Our country in the most uncertain situation since 1940-1941, when Hitler was at the Channel Ports. All of these things, all of them, are ignored by a British media fixated on what Jeremy Corbyn did or didn't mutter under his breath.
Indeed, yes, and we will come on to that later. But I somehow think, George, this drone story is not going to go away. But from one sort of droning on to another, if you like, and I want to move swiftly across to CNN, George. CNN said, shocking Syria withdrawal plan is pure Trump. This is, of course, the news that Trump is withdrawing US troops from Syria, saying that ISIS has effectively been defeated, job done, over and out, everything's good, we're off. Now, the reaction to this has been quite interesting, to say the least, because you've had a lot of Republicans come out sort of condemning Trump's plan. You've had the liberal press going into a metaphorical meltdown. And I'm sort of sitting here thinking, well, this is very odd, because you had Trump in his election campaign saying, yes, I'm going to no more Middle Eastern wars. We're going to withdraw the troops. No more Middle Eastern wars. And then, of course, this year you had the Duma nerve agent attack that never actually was a nerve agent attack, and Trump's bombing of Syria after that, going against his election pledge, which seemed to be sort of influenced by the deep state. And now he's done full circle again, and he appears to be completely going off on his own whim against what the deep state and the agencies in America want, and withdrawing all troops. What's your assessment of this? Because I'm slightly scratching my head on this one, I have to say.
Well, I'm glad you approached it from that standpoint. Mm. CNN, the liberal news network, has its knickers in a collective twist over the possibility of withdrawing from an illegal occupation of a foreign territory. Liberal Democrats from Hollywood, like Bette Midler, Mia Farrow, are taking to Twitter to denounce Trump for appeasing dictators and withdrawing American forces, again, I repeat, who are in illegal occupation of somebody else's country. Indeed. In the Middle East. And Donald Trump has an electoral mandate to do this. Mm-hmm. He ran on the platform, as you said, that the Americans should not be in Syria. Mm. And now that he's pulling the forces out, they're trying to stop him. And I even saw one liberal in America tweet today that this decision to withdraw their sons and husbands from harm's way in the Middle East will be very distressing to the spouses and families of the military personnel involved. Go figure. Go figure that one. That the wives of soldiers sent into the Syrian desert to face the possibility of death or even decapitation by ISIS fanatics, they're going to be upset that Donald Trump has withdrawn their husbands and sons from harm's way. The world has turned right and left, black, white, truth, lies. I mean, Orwell, you should be alive at this hour. The proper response to this should be, well, about bloody time, Donald.
Exactly.
2.5 years nearly, and you have been doing the opposite of what you said you would do. So, on the principle, as I said, that a stop clock is right twice a day, he's now doing the right thing. Sing hallelujah. Sing hallelujah. It's Christmas.
If it is about bloody time, I mean, the US involvement in Syria from the start has been little more than yet another proxy geopolitical war, much along the same sort of blueprint as Iraq, if you want. But what they didn't factor in was the Russians' involvement. And of course, Russia completely scuppers the US Western imperialist agenda for Syria, which was the same as Iraq, as we know, to go in there, take out Assad, and redraw the country with lots of McDonald's signs and lots of green zones and turn it into another Iraq. But Russia stopped all that. And while it's a bit too little too late, I think, yes, we should welcome Trump. And of course, the liberal press are going to have a meltdown. I mean, they're as much funded by the military-industrial complex as the Republicans are, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, in fact, the Democrats have led the United States into rather more wars than the Republicans have. And if the liberal Democrat Hillary Clinton had her way, there would be full-scale war in Syria between the so-called West and the so-called international community, which can never get a majority for its policy in the United Nations, so it does it anyway. Exactly. We'd have been in full-scale war. And it has come to something, hasn't it? That the liberal media, The Guardian, has denounced Trump's decision. The liberal EU has denounced it today. The French government has denounced it. They want war more than right-wing Republicans do.
Absolutely.
Right-wing Republicans want to withdraw into their own borders and fix their own problems. Left-wing Democrats want to go around the world bombing and occupying other people's countries. So what is left and what is right in those circumstances? For me, if you support NATO, if you support the EU, if you support foreign imperialist interventions, you're not left at all, however red the tie is that you're wearing.
Absolutely. And I think, and it's very true. Just to wrap this section up, I'm very interested in your thoughts, actually. How do you think Syria is going to play out in 2019? Because if this withdrawal continues, it leaves the rest of the allied forces, as it were, in a rather difficult position.
These allies are up the creek without a paddle, because, of course, these are merely the rats that follow the elephant for its droppings. You can't go around the world threatening people with America's army if America's army is withdrawing. And so all these little rats that were following the elephant will now have to scarper, because none of them are capable of involvement independently in this war, even if their people would allow them. And in fact, in plain sight, it's beginning to happen. The president of Sudan, Bashir, who's not supposed to be allowed to travel, by the way, under international court ruling. There's a travel ban on him. But he traveled to Damascus. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, he's closely allied with Saudi Arabia. He's in Damascus now, meeting the president of Syria. The UAE has just reopened its embassy in Damascus. Saudi Arabia is utterly preoccupied with its own internal problems and its problem on its border with Yemen and how it's going to get out of the Khashoggi imbroglio. The US has chosen Turkey over them, which is good news for Turkey. It's good news for Qatar. It's bad news for the Kurds, who once again have been picked up, put down, picked up again, put down, picked up, put down. Decade after decade after decade. Maybe one day they'll learn that the United States is a false friend not to be relied on. So here's what I've been opining on today. I believe that the Syria war, the war to defeat ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria, has now turned into a kind of Stalingrad. After Stalingrad, nothing was ever the same again. The course of the Second World War irrevocably turned, and ineluctably fascism was defeated at still much greater cost, but the course of the war was predictable from then onwards. I believe the defeat of the imperial adventure in Syria has changed everything. For a start, Russia is now the preeminent power in the Arab world. Even today, where another hideous satanic decapitation of two young Scandinavian women in Morocco in the Atlas Mountains, with the beasts in human form filming themselves, cutting off the heads of young girls, calling them enemies of God as they did so. The Moroccans today are demanding that their government bring Russia in to Morocco to deal with these Satanists, these death cultists. And all over the Arab world, people are looking now not to the United States as the major power in their region, but to Russia. Russia has changed the course of the war in Syria, which means also in Lebanon, means also in Iraq. It has an alliance with Iran. So just count, do the numbers, do the maths. All those people, all that oil and gas, already now in the Russian ambit, looking to Russia as an ally rather than the United States. Equally, and little noticed, China decided late in the day to embrace the Syrian conflict as part of its strategic depth for in a way reasons which are not easy to discern. People thought, well, China's not interested in the Middle East, but it's interested in the defeat of Islamist terrorism because it feels under threat in Xinjiang province from exactly these kind of people. Indeed, many of the people from Xinjiang were traveling on Turkish passports, fighting with ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria. Secondly, one of China's major priorities is oil and gas and security of oil and gas, because China has almost everything, but it doesn't have oil and gas. So the strategic depth of China now includes those parts of the Middle East where its ally, close ally, Russia, are now in the preeminent position. So the world changed in a way. You can almost see the sun setting in the West and rising in the East. And instead of trying to manage that and be friends with the East, countries like ours, Britain and the United States and France, on whom the sun is setting, are actually railing against what's going on in the world, making enemies, more and more bitter enemies, of people that are actually on the up while we're on the down.
Fascinating, and a fascinating analogy about the sun setting, George. Yes, I totally agree with all that. I think 2019 is going to be a particularly interesting year for the history books. You made an interesting sort of rats following around an elephant. Moving on to our final story, but this time sort of more rats in a sack, as it were. Twitter wanted us to talk about Jeremy Corbyn, of course, being accused of calling Theresa May a stupid woman when actually he said stupid people. Now, for me, George, this was fascinating. It wasn't fascinating. It was predictable. But it was fascinating watching this story unfold, because you could physically see the establishment media and the right rump of the Labour Party and the rats in the Conservative Party. You could see this machinery and its cogs literally starting to turn as soon as Corbyn mouths that stupid phrase, and then whatever he mouthed afterwards. Most staggering for me, as you touched upon at the start of the show, was the amount of bloody time that was wasted on this in Parliament. It was absolutely outrageous. There was an important debate going on that day on calling for a cumulative impact assessment of welfare-related reforms since 2010, which was supposed to start at 2 p.m. Because of all this bullshit about what Corbyn said, and then the emergency Brexit debate, this got pushed back till 7 p.m. and there were sick and disabled people waiting in Parliament from midday who had to wait until 7 o'clock that night to get in to hear this debate. What's your assessment of this? It was just preposterous.
Well, I see it as quite a classic false flag. It has been partially successful, I'm guessing. We haven't got any polling on it yet, but we will, I'm sure, in time. But if you've got every television station, every radio station, and every newspaper on the attack on the same subject against the leader of the opposition, Labour must have sustained some, hopefully, short-term damage. As so often, I believe that Corbyn handled this the wrong way. Let me tell you what I would have done if I were in his shoes. I would have come out of the chamber and I would have said, I didn't describe her as a stupid woman, but now that I've got your attention, I will. She's a stupid woman for the following reasons. And he could have still been talking at 10 o'clock that night. He could have said that she's a stupid woman because look at the way in which she's plunged the country into chaos. She's been found in contempt of Parliament. She thinks a pantomime routine on the last Prime Minister's question before a long Christmas and New Year holiday was an appropriate use of time. She's actually not just a stupid woman, but a wicked woman for the following reasons.
Yes.
And again, he could have spoken till 10 o'clock at night, adumbrating the wickedness of this woman. He should have gone on the offensive right from the beginning. Today, he has done. And how much better it is. He chastised the BBC reporter that there was a man died on the steps of Parliament, a homeless man who was working, by the way, a working homeless man died on the steps of Parliament, and you haven't even reported it, and you're following me around in the street with your cameras to speak about something I didn't say in Parliament yesterday. And he didn't add, but he might have, shame on you. Is this what you think journalism is? When you were dreaming of being a journalist, when you were growing up, is this what you had in mind? He has nothing to lose by going on the offensive. I'll tell you, down my street, everybody, man and woman, considers Theresa May to be a stupid woman. In every street in the land, the majority of people consider her to be a stupid woman. So if he didn't call her that, and for the record, I've known him for nearly 40 years, he's not a liar. If he says he didn't say it, and by the way, he's just about the most politically correct individual in the land, so he almost certainly wouldn't say something like that.
Absolutely.
So he's politically correct. He's not a liar. He's a 35-year member of Parliament. He's the leader of the opposition. He is effectively speaking on oath at the dispatch box. If he says he didn't say it, it should be accepted that he didn't say it. But he should have said it, because she is stupid. And if not in the chamber, he should have said it outside.
No, absolutely. But if I may, we've discussed this before again, haven't we? And this is an ongoing problem with Corbyn and his team. They are too slow to react. They're constantly like this. They're constantly on the back foot, almost. They seem to... I actually thought they'd improved.
Well, they've done
slightly.
It again tonight, Steve. A man, Ivan Lewis, MP for Bury, who's suspended from the Labour Party following allegations of sexual impropriety with a very young woman. And with a history of it, in his previous role as a minister, he was forced to apologize for intimate texts, unwanted intimate texts, sent to a young aide in his department, has now resigned from the Labour Party, claiming it's about anti-Semitism, more to do with anti-Semitism. But anti-Semitism is what he has claimed. Now, why doesn't Jeremy Corbyn or his spokesman come out and say, this man has resigned because he was about to be tried and his accusers about to be heard on accusations, allegations of sexual impropriety? To now describe his departure as having anything to do with anti-Semitism is the most corrupt hypocrisy. Why don't they go on the offensive against these people instead of allowing the media and their political enemies and their opposition on the other side of the chamber constantly undermine them? It drives me to distraction.
I agree. And this is going to have to change in 2019 because we're now on the third year of this. And as we discussed on Tobol Galloway this week, this isn't going to go away. Especially the right and the Blairites within the Labour Party, this will continue. So it'll be interesting to see how 2019 pans out. George, thank you so much. It's been a real, 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 real pleasure to work with you this year. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. It's been absolutely a joy.
My joy is unconfined. Love to Nick Lack.
Thank you, sir. And if I don't see you beforehand, which hopefully I will, have a very peaceful Christmas and New Year.
Thank you. All the best. Good night.
Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Tobol chirps back. No more Dimblebot on question time. Yes, it's all over and end of an era. And there was no question time this week either. We're all waiting for Fiona Bruce to come back from the BBC establishment retraining camp to kick off the new series in January. So to that end, I thought I would share with you one of the most staggering statements I've ever heard on the programme. It came on an episode on the 9th of November 2017 from Conservative councillor Chris Stevens. He was responding to Guardian columnist Editor Chak Roboti and his claim that the government sent disabled people to their deaths. This is absolutely staggering.
We voted for Brexit and Theresa May is fulfilling that pledge. Now, you talk using inflammatory language. You're like the Donald Trump of The Guardian. You use inflammatory language, saying that people, disabled people... You're basically accusing people that vote Conservative and Conservative representatives, such as myself, as sending people to their deaths because they're disabled. That's disgusting.
So I can actually introduce you to some of the people who are disabled.
Well, we can all introduce people to each other.
Who can tell you about
their
friends.
But you use language like Donald Trump.
It's very little resemblance to Donald Trump.
You rancid, rotund Tory. Where would you like me to begin with this? An Oxford University study, for example, found that 590 people had taken their own lives linked to the government's work capability assessment. It also linked it to 279,000 additional cases of mental health issues and 725,000 additional antidepressant descriptions. But moreover, we have had numerous statistics relating to deaths at the hands of the DWP. First off, between December 2011 and February 2014, 91 people a month were dying after the DWP told them they were fit for work. Then, more recently, the DWP was forced to reveal that 10 claimants a day were dying after it told them they need to begin moving towards work in the Employment and Support Alliance work-related activity group. This is without the five United Nations reports since June 2016. One from the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities said that the UK government had committed grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights, and it had created a human catastrophe in this country. And all of that's without universal credit, where we're seeing rent arrears rocketing, food bag use skyrocketing, and people literally not having enough money to get by. And on top of that, you have my own research which showed that despite the government's claims, they have cut disability benefits like PIP since 2009-2010. They're essentially lying through their teeth, as they always do with anything in relation to disabled people. This government is disgusting. The Conservatives are disgusting, and you dirty Tory councillor who even dared to question what disabled people have been put through at the hands of your party, you make me sick. So question time. I'd like to say I'm looking forward to your return in the new year, but unfortunately, even with a new host, I think it's on the Topple Uncaged shit. Podcast.
And here's this week's no banger. Exception.
I'm joined by the amazing rap duo who I thoroughly love to bits. They are funny, eloquent, talented, but also a bit conscious. It's only too many teas. Guys, Leon, Ross, thank you so much for joining me on my festive edition of the podcast.
Mr. Topple. Hello.
What a lovely introduction, Steve. Thank you.
My pleasure. Guys, you have had a sort of mind-blowingly busy year, as it were. But for the Topple Uncageders who are listening to this, tell me a bit about yourselves, because you're from my side of the river. You're from South London. Camberwell is sort of where you hail from, as it were. But how did you guys first start off? Because you've been doing this quite a few years now, haven't you?
We live in South London. Mm-hmm. But we actually met where... at the top of this motorway one line where Ross is right now.
That's Wakefield, yeah?
Yeah, up north. So Leon went to uni up here. So I was born and bred here until I moved down south about 12 years ago.
Okay.
And Leon went to uni here and we were like, I think I was only rapper in Wakefield at the time.
Until Leon came into town.
Leon rolled. And someone went, Ross, you should meet Leon. He raps too. So yeah, so that's how it started, and we used to rap really, really rubbish bars, mainly smoking certain herbs.
Yes, this is sage and thyme, yeah.
Yeah, and then the rest is history, and then we ended up in in Camberwell about 8 years ago, so we started in the same city for the first time in a long time, and started writing some stuff, and then Two Matees was born about 6 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, it's weird. We'd always like just kind of meet up and rap, but it wasn't until 8 years ago we were in the same city, and then we had a trip to Morocco. We found some cheap flights to Morocco, and for some bizarre reason thought, let's make a music video while we're in Morocco. So then wrote a song based on a Google image search of what we thought we'd find in Morocco. Okay. came back, made the video, put it out, everyone loved it, and we thought, oh, we should do some more of this, and then we've never stopped.
Absolutely. It sounds very interesting. I'm not going to ask what you were doing in Morocco.
Making a music video, Steve.
Of course. Naturally. So this year has been quite phenomenal for you. You've played numerous festivals this year. You've had several songs out, not least the one I had the privilege of writing about, which was Not Enough Bees, which was an absolutely genius track. It was absolutely brilliant. But I find your style fascinating because you're quite, it's quite sort of old
old school, fairly traditional hip hop. But you guys then just sort of blow people's minds with injecting sort of wry humour into it. There's also a definite sort of conscious streak running through your music. Is doing sort of socially conscious, slightly political music, Ross, something that you'd plan to do from the outset?
Yeah, I think it's definitely developed, and I think we kind of made music like old school hip hop and kind of music to party to, and also like sort of like escapism, because a lot of the world obviously is really serious, and we all talk about it constantly and read about it, and it's nice to just have a party and sort of jam with your mates. And I think that was like the intention of our music at first, and then after a few years, yeah, last year we put our debut album out, the one with like Neighbours on it, and I'll say the tease that we'll hear later, and that did really well. And then I think this year it kind of gave us a bit of a license to actually we're going to sort of stand up and talk about what we believe in a bit more, which is a sort of artistic decision. So, yeah, we wrote the Bees rap, and we've written some political stuff that we've not put out yet, and we've written a track about climate change, which we spent a long time doing, which is also not out yet. But yeah, that more of that stuff will be coming next year alongside new albums as well.
Excellent stuff. That sounds really, really good. I'm looking forward to that. Leon, so as an artist, the two of you, what do you prefer? Is it live performance that you sort of really get off on, or is it the recording process? What's your favourite part of what you do? I'm quite interested.
The writing bit's fun. The performing bit's fun. The recording bit gives you time for your critical mind to kick in, which is an absolute nightmare. So you're live, you're lost in the moment, you're writing, you're kind of lost in the moment. And then as soon as you get into the studio and you start recording, you're listening back. And then it's like, oh, that little tiny sound could maybe be slightly different. And then you do it again, and you do it again, and then you've recorded it 10 times, and you don't even know what you're listening to anymore.
Why do I even play music? Everyone's going to hate me.
Yeah. Yeah. But live I think is where we really kind of shine, because we sort of have a brilliant rapport between us and with other people. And I think there's something about our show. People like to come and see us performing live for more than just the music.
Because you did a sort of a brief UK tour this year. Then I'm correct, you're going on tour next year as well, aren't you, Ross? Is that right?
Yeah. So we've got the most epic thing we've ever planned in our career. Yeah. So we're going to Australia next week, and then we've got like a 20-date tour that goes through Australia and then into Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, China, and then Japan and India. We're just sorting out at the end. But it's over like 3.5 months, and it's called Rap Year.
Rap Year.
And so we're going to kind of travel in between each gig. So each gig's about a week apart, and then we're going to be thoroughly documenting the whole thing and talking about some cool stuff in each place that we go to, and kind of doing a bit of a sort of a travel vlog, and meeting up with local musicians as well, and making some stuff on the road as well. So
you guys just haven't stopped. That's absolutely mad. Who would you say, Leon, your sort of musical influences are?
I kind of grew up in Leicester, this town. So I kind of grew up listening to the radio and watching the TV, and didn't really know that much existed outside of that. So I was quite limited in my exposure to what I heard, other than kind of like a bit of soul music from my parents. It wasn't until I got to university that I found hip hop, and sort of like everything just changed then. I just started listening to every rapper that I possibly could. But my sort of my early influences was quite like soul-y and poppy and R&B influenced until I sort of found these underground music scenes of hip hop and drum and bass and everything.
And Ross, are you kind of similar? Was that is that story the same for you, or is it different?
I'm nowhere near as cheesy as Leon. my brother was a DJ, and he's like 4 years older than me. And he just like bought wicked records from like when he was 16. He was buying like Big Daddy Kane and Tribe Called Quest and Jurassic 5, and he was just in some real good hip hop at the time. And he wouldn't let me near his deck, so I just sort of sit on the end of his bed learning all the words to all the raps. And I think that's the only reason why I can rap, because I just learned all Big Daddy Kane's album when I was 12.
Well, guys, you certainly can rap. You're extremely dexterous. Your ability to spit is extremely impressive. So just to finish up, we need to talk a brief bit about politics. 2019, do you think the country is going to go to even more shit than it is already? I mean, we've got the Brexit chaos still rumbling on. We've got the Conservatives in themselves in perpetual chaos, but still looking fairly strong and stable in terms of the fact they're still bloody in government. And of course, we are facing climate chaos. I mean, I suppose the main question is, do you think we're going to head to a point where there will be a general election and maybe Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party could be elected? Place your bets now, Leon. Do you think that's going to happen?
No.
Ross?
I think the Tories will cling to power for as long as humanly possible until they completely sort of capitulate from within inside themselves. But what you said about climate chaos, I mean, this is like the key issue that we're talking all this crap that no one's kind of really knows the solution to way out of. We know how many sort of like negatives there are, but then obviously there's some sort of potential silver linings of Brexit if we get a good government in charge that can you know take care of our country properly. And you kind of want to be an optimist the whole time with this stuff, but it's just a bit of a farce, and I feel like I'm retracting from it now because it's just so sad.
Leon, Ross, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very, very much.
It's great to have you on. And keep up the amazing work and writing, Steve. You're a bad man.
Thank you. It's very kind. So this is a track from Too Many Teas. It's absolutely fantastic. This is God Save the Teas. Check this shit out. Absolutely brilliant. Guys, thank you.
Nice one. Merry Christmas. Too many teas.
And that's it. Episode 6 of Top of the Caged is done. I would like to thank my fantastic guest, me old mucker, George Galloway. Follow him on Twitter. It's at George Galloway. And the fantastic Too Many Teas. Follow them on Twitter. It's at Too Many Teas. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to Nicola Jeffrey, my gorgeous, beautiful girlfriend. Love you lots. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. And my in-house singer, the fantastic Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_Star113. Finally, thank you to The Canary for uncaging me. Join us. More details at www.thecanary.co. Otherwise, that's it. Have yourself a peaceful Christmas, and I will see you just before the new year. Ta-ta!
Uncaged.